All right, Matthew, welcome to episode 52 of the Performance Advantage podcast. This week, we're talking to world-renowned sports scientist, Dr. Steve Stannard, about his experiences in training with cancer. Also, a bit of a catch-up between you and me and our new course that we're introducing online. Shout out to the sponsors of the podcast, EnduranceTrainingHub.com and SmartMTBTraining.com, online interactive self-coaching platforms to help you become a better athlete. All right, Matt, what have you been up to, mate?
Well, we are in week 3 of being locked down, and I must say I'm getting pretty bored. I just really, want to go out and ride trails, and our local trails are closed. We had such amazing weather, And, I think that hopefully the lockdown clears up soon, and we can get back out there, because things are looking pretty good here in New Zealand. But now it's starting to rain a lot, and over the last week, I kind of haven't really wanted to go riding as much, but then I looked back on my training peaks. I'm like, oh, well, I should probably have a break anyway. So it's been a really good chance to stay inside, drink way more coffees than usual, and work on the websites. So we are really, really close to launching the BreakAce web app, which has honestly been a long time coming. And it's just really, really, really exciting to see it actually coming together. And, you know, you can upload your data online and click through it and analyze it, and all the analysis is there. So for me, that has been the most exciting thing. And then obviously working with all my athletes one-on-one, there have been a lot of changes going on for the athletes where events are canceled and we're changing things on the fly when we weren't expecting to, but everyone has been setting, everyone that's testing now, they've all been setting personal best power outputs, which has been
Are all your athletes smashing training at the moment?
Yeah, it's crazy.
Yeah, same. I am as well. It's just, there is zero distractions. It's been really good to nail down hey, look, this isn't working. This is recovery's on point. There's no heading off for the weekend or anything that we need to try and structure things around. And everyone's just on the grind.
Yeah. Yeah. For some people we've gone back to maintenance phase, but for others it's well, this is a good chance to try what we've been planning on, because you're planning to be peak fitness anyway. And everyone that we set these new tests up for, they've set new best power outputs, and it's I really wish there was a race so we could put this to use on the course. But, setting new power output records for yourself and trying new things in training and seeing how that affects you. Sometimes without a race in the way, dare I say, you can learn new things and reach new limits. And it's been really cool. It's been great growing experience for athletes and coach. So I've really benefited from it as well.
Yeah. There's, one athlete I work with in particular. We thought that his capacity to train would increase. Now he's a laborer. So, a lot less stress within the day, but actually he was near his limits anyway. Over the last few weeks, we haven't been able to, he's really broken down. Still achieving great outputs, but it was super interesting to now apply that moving forward. Look, under the best possible conditions for you to train as much as possible, you still broke down. So those limits that you set on yourself for everyone else can do it because of this, that's not going to work. So now it's I don't need to set those arbitrary numbers on my weekly volume, because I clearly, like, I can't handle
it. Yeah.
And that's what I did myself as well. I set some pretty ambitious training goals for the last couple of weeks and I achieved them, but at a pretty big cost. Like I've been, as was brought to my attention by my lovely wife, it was like, you're way more tired than you normally are. And I'm like, yeah, but I'm trying to really, you know, without so many distractions, push myself. And then she goes, you know, what if you shifted this and did this, within your training? And I was like, no one, especially us, Matt, like we're coaches. It's our job. You don't want to admit you're doing something wrong. So as much as I wanted to be like, whatever, I know what I'm doing. I took her advice, just didn't say anything, thought about it. And I was like, oh, she's right. It's actually a better way of structuring my, what I've tried to do. But we've had these opportunities to do that, to learn about ourselves and our athletes. And, it's been great for stuff like that.
Yeah. Yeah. And eventually, you know, the races are going to be back and, you know, hopefully that's sooner than later because we love competing and it's nice to have that carrot dangling in front of you to have a race instead of just always doing trainings. But, you know, this is a great opportunity for everyone to grow and everyone, like, we just need to give ourselves that chance to learn and grow at this time.
Yeah. And what we've been able to do, Dr. Matthew and myself, is put together a 6-part online course to make sports science more understandable and more applied for you guys to help yourselves either just learn more or to really help coach yourself.
Yeah. This has always been like one of the goals because, we can train you and we can give you plans, but one of the things that we do with our own athletes is they pick up information along the way and we eventually make ourselves redundant where actually, you know, it's not great job security, but we teach them so that actually they can do this now, right? They can take the reins. And that learning is something that we really wanted to be able to offer to everyone. So now we're doing it in an easy to digest interactive online format. And we pretty much train you to build your own training program. And then we have a look at your training program. We have quizzes along the way and online, I don't want to say lectures, but tutorials on how to use all the information that we can gather. And that, that webpage is live. PerformanceAdvantagePodcast.com. Believe it or not, we haven't had that, but now we have it and, you can get all the information about the course there. And for, another few weeks, we have a 50% discount to sign up for that course. Yeah, it's actually really exciting to finally be launching this. And this has been an opportunity for us to do it.
Yeah, has been great for that. And there's a good segue, Matt, because you say making ourselves redundant. And that was our mentor, Steve Stannard, would always say that as a coach, you should coach yourself out of a job. You should teach athletes how to, you know, understand their training and their physiology. And that's who we happen to have on the podcast today, Dr. Steve Stannard. And amongst an array of experiences, Steve has recently undergone treatment for multiple myeloma, and he'll describe that in more detail. But why we wanted to get him on was really talk through what a lot of people don't talk about, and that is cancer, and then exercising with cancer and just his experiences in being a, you know, very intellectual and highly well-read and versed scientist being diagnosed, going through treatment and exercising.
Yeah, Steve, I don't think he toots his own horn enough. He has, I'm not even sure how many hundreds of scientific papers he's authored in exercise physiology. We've had him on before, so his kids are all amazing athletes as well. We had his son, Robert Stannard, on the show. He races for on the Pro Tour, road cycling. And Steve has a really good way of explaining things. And since this is his own personal experience going through cancer and the daily struggle that he went through, and, you know, as he goes on to say, it wasn't easy. But he's fit. Like, he's really, really fit. And he was able to bring his fitness back, and he attributes a lot of his ability to get back to top fitness on just being fit in general at the start. So I think this was a really good chat with Steve. And, you know, cancer is going to affect us all in one way, whether we know someone or it's ourselves. And all our audience, they're in the training, so I think this is a really good topic.
All right, here's Dr. Steve Stannard.
Hey, Steve, welcome to the show.
Again.
Yeah, you're our first repeat guest, actually.
Oh, okay. That's nice, I guess.
Yeah. Well, there's no prize that goes with it, but yeah, thanks for coming on. Because last time what we talked about is raising champions, and that ended up being a really popular episode, and it was really great to get your input. But this time we're talking about something really different, and I think, you know, it's a little bit taboo in a way. We're going to talk about training with cancer, and not because we want to, it's mostly because we want to kind of talk about the elephant in the room, and because most of us will be affected by cancer, whether it's directly or indirectly, and all our listeners are training or athletes or are associated with athletes. So for us to be able to talk about the science behind exercising with cancer from a scientist who exercised with cancer, I think you can offer a really interesting perspective.
Yeah. Interesting. It's been an interesting journey. And I'm glad, I'm hopeful that, and the journey continues, I might add. I'm hopeful that I can be useful in terms of providing information and a story that gives a bit of support to other people that might be on the same journey.
So what, we might as well start like from the beginning, like what kind of cancer you have and how it came about, I guess, like if it's a hereditary one or how, you know, just the general background.
Yeah, so cancer's a big word, the big C. There's many, many types of cancer. It's a bit like saying you've got exercise.
Yeah.
We know how many types of exercise there are. There's heaps. You know, there's biking, there's running, there's rowing, canoeing, playing different games, sports. Well, cancer's the same. There's a whole lot of different sorts of cancer. And it really, cancer really describes when there's cell, unwanted cell multiplication in your body in some place that can be, and of all the different types of cells in your body, you know, that cell, unwanted cell multiplication, that's why there's many different types. But sometimes that unwanted and unchecked multiplication of cells is harmless. Sometimes it's really dangerous. It kills a lot of the time. Sometimes you can cure it, sometimes you can't. Sometimes you can manage it, sometimes you can't. I've got this thing called myeloma, which is a cancer. It's a blood cancer. So it means I've got some plasma cells, which is one type of white blood cell, at some point there was a white blood cell in my body or a plasma cell that decided it wanted to keep replicating when it shouldn't have. And it, you know, it sort of started to breed like rabbits, and what happens is you get a lot of this these plasma cells start to build up in your blood, and it starts displacing the production of other cells like red blood cells. Which means you end up with an anemia, which is a pretty nasty thing to have if it gets really bad. The other things that happen is these plasma cells, when you get too many of them, they start essentially stopping bone resorption. So your bones start getting eaten away, like osteoporosis, and so it presents often. Or when I say that, it often presents as a bone breakage that doesn't heal, or bone pain, and people go to their GP and they feel a bit down, and there's a bone niggling pain, and it's because their bones been worn away by these excess beta cells in their blood, which is causing pain. So it's a relatively slow growing sort of a cancer. This particular type, it's sort of a little bit like lymphoma, which is a different blood cancer, or leukemia, which is different blood cancer. And I've got what they call multiple myeloma, which means that it presents as a problem in the bones, or where these cancer cells in particular, or there's a bone lesion, is what they call them. It happens in more than one place. So if you can imagine, compare it to something like breast cancer, which occurs in the breast initially, or brain cancer, which occurs in the brain, it's there in a little spot. And whereas mine's a blood cancer, which means it's systemic. Some other cancers can also become systemic, of course, which is pretty nasty. So mine starts off as systemic, which means the treatment's quite different. So, and a skin cancer, you can compare, that starts off in the skin often. And I've got little skin cancers, basal cell carcinomas from, too many young years of spending too much time in the sun in Australia. But, that just is a fairly relatively benign thing that just stays in the skin. So being systemic cancer, myeloma is really hard to treat. So treatment for cancers are obviously very different, and I guess we'll talk a little bit about that.
We were working together. We were all at the university at the time, and you were just Steve, and just normal guy, always riding, riding pretty much every day. One day you came in and said, "Oh yeah, I have cancer." And like for all of us, like that came as a really big surprise, because like you were just so active, you're fit, you're healthy. How did you notice that? Cause we couldn't see it in you. We just saw the normal Steve, but somehow you found out that you had cancer. How did you find out?
Well, sort of two things there, I'd say, is firstly, cancer doesn't choose, and you've heard that before. Being physically fit, I don't think in many types of cancers, most types of cancers, even perhaps that being physically fit doesn't necessarily make you immune, or it doesn't make you immune. That's the first thing I would say. Cancer doesn't choose. So being a person that does lots of exercise, tries to eat reasonably well, didn't seem to make any difference. I'll get back to that though, and you can ask me later why do you think I got it, and I'll try and answer it. But I only found out, so I didn't get bone pain or anything, but I was in a pretty busy phase of life, pretty stressed. I've probably felt a little bit run down, but every year I get a blood test. Because that's the old athlete in me. Get a blood test. Yeah, that's what you do. In fact, if you're an athlete, you probably should do it once every 6 months, but once a year. It's sort of it's like taking your car in for a waff, really. And at the time, I was a bit run down, and I thought I was trying to burn the candle at all three ends. And I thought, it's a good time to get a blood test, because if there's anything there, it'll get picked up. And I thought, I had a blood test, and what happens is normally there's nothing untoward, you never hear anything about it again, your GP doesn't get back to you. And this time he said, I want to talk to you about the blood test. I thought, oh shit, it's my prostate, being at the time just about to turn 50. That's what every bloke's worried about. you know, it turns out it wasn't that. Turns out my calcium was high, my protein was high, and they'd sort of been a little bit high in the last couple of years, but they both weren't high at the same time. And luckily I've got a fairly astute GP where he thought, oh, that's not right, rang up a specialist and said, oh, no, you better send him in. And sent me in, did a pretty much to a specialist, a hematologist. He pretty much there and then took a got a nasty big needle and took a sample of a bone marrow and it's got sent away to be processed. And, yep, I had cancerous cells in my bone marrow. And that was a bit, that was pretty hard to be told, okay, you've got cancer, and not only that, it's an incurable cancer because myeloma, you can't cure it. And so, yeah, that was a hard moment. And that's how I found out. So, lucky in a way, because, you know, I didn't have any, apart from being a bit run down, I didn't have any symptoms. I had no bone pain, which means the cancer hadn't eaten away too badly, although subsequent MRIs had shown that it had seemed to have eaten away a bit in some of my bones. I didn't feel anything. I guess I felt relatively normal. Although I said a bit, and the thing about it also is when you're under the weather and when you're about to hit 50, there's expectations, which I think now are relatively sort of wrong. But there's expectations that, you know, you should feel a few niggles, that you should feel a bit run down, that you shouldn't be able to run as fast or do as much as you used to. I think that's a bit wrong. Steve, you're 50, you should feel some of those things. Well, you know, if I had my time again and if I knew then what I know now, then I'd probably think, yeah, something's definitely a little bit amiss because I shouldn't be feeling quite like that. And I remember doing an exercise test with, I think it was with you, Will, or Emma, and my VO2 max had taken quite a dive. And I thought, that's a bit strange, but I must be really unfit. But being unfit before had never really affected my VO2 max much. So when I look back at that, it was probably a sign that my blood was clogging up a bit and my oxygen carrying capacity had reduced. So that's sort of how it all happened. And then as we say, once it's diagnosed, you get on the train.
Yeah. It wasn't super long before you underwent treatment, all right, which pretty much knocked you out, because you had the it was a very involved intravenous chemotherapy, right?
Yeah, well, see, with something like, I learned a lot about cancer treatment. Cancer treatment is when you've got a defined, and it's not a common cancer, but it's not uncommon either. Something like 1% of the population have something like this diagnosed or undiagnosed, or something. It's along those lines. So what it means is there's a fairly defined treatment regime that you have. And what happens is, you know, and this is, you know, I'm not a medical specialist and certainly not an oncologist or hematologist, but, you know, I gather it works something like this, that, you know, there's a group of these really well-qualified experts in the area, and they get together and they work out the best treatment regime for particular people. And it's like a recipe. So when I say you get on the train, pretty much you get, say, okay, well, you've got this, you have a chat with your, and in my case, it's the hematologist that looks after me. And I've got to say, those people at Mid Central are just brilliant. And I've, you know, they're great. It's pretty defined. And they say, well, we're going to do this, and this is what you got to do. And it's just, you get on the train, and there's a certain number. You know, it's stopping here and it's stopping here, and or you have to get off here and get on here, and it's just a recipe, and you follow it. It's like, okay, I've got a year-long training program, and my treatment, my training program, so to speak, my train lasted for 14 months, And I knew what I had to do for 14 months. And we got onto it quickly, and I got the treatment. And again, that's different for some people. But when you sort of get diagnosed, they say they put you in a particular category. Okay, we've got a person here of this age, first diagnosed at this level. Boom, boom, we're going to do this, and away you go. My first round of treatment, I started chemo on my 50th birthday. I've got a picture of myself at turning 50, and I had to take a whole stack of pills. So my first one was, I think it was 5 months of injections, and I started a series of infusions, but that was about sort of repairing the bone. But injections once a week, and basically pills every day, and some pretty nasty stuff.
So that does not sound good. Like, it sounds like it's really hard to deal with. And I'm just kind of wondering, because you talk about this recipe, this one size fits all approach.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's great that this one size fits all approach was created by experts in their field. So I liken that kind of to like what we do. And I know it's totally different, but we all work with athletes. And we work with lots of different athletes. And generally speaking, we follow the same principles with most athletes. But we know that if we're working with an athlete and we really want to bring the best out of them, that following a one-size-fits-all approach is not going to work, right? So that's why we work with our athletes one-on-one, and we look at a broad level of their history, and we look at fitness markers in all different aspects along a spectrum of performances. And what we do then as the experts is we devise a plan moving forward that's personalized to everyone.
Yeah.
Now, it sounds like that doesn't happen with cancer treatment.
No, I sort of say, cancer treatment is changing. At the moment, most cancer treatment is chemotherapy. Or a lot of it is, and because I had a systemic cancer, because it was right through me, I couldn't get targeted treatment. Like, you can't say, okay, the cancer's here, we'll zap it with some radiotherapy. You know, you can't just target it. So you've got to take a systemic approach. I liken it to saying, okay, I've got dandelions in my lawn, so I'm going to get rid of the dandelions by using Roundup. In other words, I'll kill everything, and then I know I've got rid of the dandelions, but there's been a bit of collateral. I've killed everything else. That's chemotherapy. And I'll get back to that in a moment. Just to sort of further what happened after the 5 months is then they harvested my stem cells, I had a nasty infusion of something, and then they harvested my stem cells, and then I had a really nasty infusion of something else. Melphalan, and basically it's a chemical that was derived from mustard gas. I think they learnt this in the First World War, and it basically kills off all your bone marrow. So I had a time, and I ended up in hospital in isolation, because if it kills off your bone marrow, you've got no immunity whatsoever. But the idea is if you kill off all your bone marrow, you kill off all these cancer cells as well, and so I had this infusion that it was about three quarters of a gram, only three quarters of a gram of this stuff, and by crikey, does that have a big effect? Amazing. And that's chemotherapy, chemicals that are nasty things, and then they put the stem cells back in, and that was what they call an allogenic an autologous, stem cell transplant. And then ideally what happens, you've killed off all your growing bits in your bone marrow where all your blood cells come from. You put stem cells back and hopefully they'll take. You cross your fingers. Meanwhile, you've got no immunity, and you stay there in hospital until they do. And then you start a recovery process. And the recovery process, they told me, would take, you'd start to feel normal after 3 months. So that by that time, you know, it was nearly a year later from my diagnosis. That's not quite a year later from a diagnosis. And then after that, I went on another 5 months of consolidation treatment. So the whole thing lasted about 14 months. So that just finishing off what it's done is, that was about 18 months ago when I finished that, and it knocked the cancer back almost completely, but not quite. And that's why they say it's an incurable thing, because it's still there, and you wait for it to get ahead of steam again. A bit like we're waiting for the virus. You're worried about the virus at the moment, COVID-19, head of steam. You're trying to. At the moment, you're sort of in the mode where you know it's still there somewhere in your bones, because you can never get rid of it all. It's hiding there, but you don't want it to come back. You cross your fingers and you think, well, I don't want it to get a head of steam up. I don't want it to come back. But going back to the stem cell transplant, it's exactly what it is. It's killing everything off and then just putting a bit of seed back, which has hopefully got none of the bad stuff in it. The trouble is, when you harvest the stem cells, initially you probably get one or two bad ones in there as well. And so when you put them all back, you know, there's almost 100% chance you'll put a couple of bad things back. But, you know, it is what it is.
Then with your fitness level and your training regime, like, you'd be, for your age, you know, in the top 1% of in terms of like aerobic fitness capacity. You know, your VO2 max is in the 70s. You're at the time were highly competitive, like masters cyclists, and you've been, you know, world-class competitive cyclists. So, like, is that, when I think about it, I think about the amount of damage we do as athletes to our body that requires repair. And we also, you know, have an increased rate of production of reactive oxygen species. And all of this, in my mind, just thinking about it simplistically, sort of would promote like the rapid or increased growth of something that proliferates like a cancer, and especially within the bone, maybe enhance or increase the rate. Like, do you think your fitness level and the training you were doing was a benefit or a decrement to?
You mean the development of the cancer before I knew that I had it?
Well, yeah. Like, if you want to touch on the development of it, and also in regards to your recovery.
Yeah, okay. Well, ask me about the exercise during the cancer and after the cancer just a bit later, and it'll sort of partition that. The stress that a person that exercises hard, like an athlete, puts themselves under in the short term is pretty tough on the body. But that's a short, you know, we're talking about competition, and even the best people on average might only compete once a week. And then you pretty much start the recovery process. The rest of the time, in actual fact, that exercise is having beneficial effects, except if you really get yourself overcooked and overtrained. And I think then that's when you're probably opening yourself up to maybe some more problems. I actually think that being fit hid the cancer. Because when I've talked to other people about how did you feel when you got this sort of thing? Oh, I felt a bit run down, and you know, and blah blah blah. Well, in actual fact, you know, as an athlete, I probably got used to feeling a bit physically run down. And not only that, you know, I had a pretty good motor. When I talked early on about you doing this test on me and it dropped a bit, well, it was still pretty, my VO2 max was still pretty good, but it had just dropped. And so I thought, oh, I'm just sort of getting back to being a normal person rather than being an athlete now. And Actually, that's the day. That's good and it's bad, because what it meant was it was bad because it's much harder to pick up something that's, especially by the medical profession, is seen as in a sort of a deleterious or a sick state. When you're an athlete, it's a lot harder to get into that physically sick state. I'm not talking about infectious type stuff, but the other side of the, so that was the bad side, in a bad way of being fit. It's a lot harder to notice when you have got something like this. But in a good way, what it meant was that I had a lot of more robustness to my bones and probably my kidneys and stuff like that, so they didn't get damaged. Yeah, so, you know, in one way I was lucky, in another way perhaps not. I think that's answered your question.
Then what about training afterwards?
During
treatment. Yeah, you also had the you had some steroid, you know, one of the steroids that they have talked about with being, you know, something that athletes,
corticosteroids,
in particular,
corticosteroids. Yeah, so I had some pretty heavy doses of dexamethasone. Dexamethasone is a corticosteroid, and you know, I think some of the elite endurance athletes have used corticosteroids to improve aspects of their performance, or it reduces inflammation, and. But it was pretty nasty. And when you take really high doses of this stuff, it gets pretty nasty. After you get over the initial shock, and it is a shock of cancer diagnosis, and I'll tell you what, it's a life changing experience. Walking into the oncology ward, not as a visitor but as a patient, that's a life-changing experience. After the initial shock of doing those sorts of things, you get into this mode of determination. You get on. It's part of getting on the train. Okay, we're on the train, and let's do this. And you just bloody well do it. And okay, I'm going to get up, going to exercise, because although no one's told me that I should exercise or that I shouldn't exercise, my gut tells me and my education and experience tells me that I've got to keep physically active. Although there is a bit of scientific literature out there saying, you know, okay, you should be, you know, it's good to keep some exercise going when you're treatment. But I tried, okay, well, I'm just going to try and stay fit, get up and do cycle, ride my bike every day. I'll even go hard 1 or 2 days a week. At the time, I was trying to get up, because by that time I'd started to take sick leave. You sort of had to be at the hospital a couple of times every week, so you get quite busy. I thought I'll try and get a regimented life. I'll get up first thing in the morning before it's light, go running, come back. I was still doing a little bit of stuff at the coffee shop. I'd still go and open up to have a semblance of normality, and then I'd come home, so I'd try and have a bit of a rest, and then I'll hop on my exercise bike and away I'll go again. Then I can go to the hospital in the afternoon or whatever, and I started off with a hiss and a roar. I'm going to do this, I'm going to do that. And I started to fall to bits pretty quickly, because I realized pretty quickly that you can't keep doing the same level of exercise that you think you should be able to do. They've got these things called performance-enhancing drugs, right? They're often based around stuff like testosterone, growth hormone, all the things that promote cell growth and recovery. When you start doing chemo, they're called performance killing drugs, because the idea of those drugs is they do exactly the opposite. They're stopping cells growing. So you go out and you try and exercise when you're on these cancer drugs and you don't recover, because that's what the drugs are doing. They're essentially not allowing you to recover. Anti-inflammatories, and most people know these days, sports scientists know that if you take a whole lot of anti-inflammatories, it slows the recovery process. So I was taking performance killing drugs. I tried to keep exercising, and it got to the point where I got crook, ended up in ED with an infection. I lost 7 kilos, and then I was just stuck on the couch watching bad movies for a lot of weeks.
Do you remember we had you come in the lab actually a bunch of times, maybe 4 or 5 times, and one of the things that you were kind of saying is you were wondering how your fuel utilization was changing as you had started these different chemotherapy drugs, and there wasn't really any literature on it. So what we did, so just so everyone knows, you came into the lab and we just had you exercise at different power outputs on the bike. I think it was maybe 150, 200, 250, 300 watts for 5 minutes. For a lot of people, you know, that'd be pretty hard, and you were on chemotherapy and you were fine. And we were collecting, you know, heart rate, and we had you hooked up to the metabolic cart. And then a few times, actually, you would follow that up and do like a max test, like a proper VO2 max test. That we only did that one a few times because I felt bad. Like, I didn't want to put you through like this. You were pushing it. And unfortunately, I lost the results. I can't find them. They're here somewhere. But do you remember kind of what you were thinking, what you wanted to look for when we were looking at that data, and maybe some of the things that had changed?
Yeah, well, what I was interested in is that, so going back to my story about exercising, no one had told me what I could and couldn't do. And, you know, being a scientist, I went to the literature. And so when you get diagnosed with this particular cancer, no one says, well, you need to go out and exercise or you shouldn't exercise. I think they just say, well, you should keep up some sort of physical activity and go and walk around the block or go and pick the paper up. Well, that's not exercise in my book. So I wanted to try and keep doing stuff, but there isn't any literature there. I mean, and there's no information, there's nothing in the literature at all about, for instance, the effect of a high dose of dexamethasone on exercise capacity. And probably of all the things I was taking, that had the most acute daily sort of effects. It'd give you a high and it'd drop you after you know, I was 4 days on, 4 days off. And when you'd feel fine when you're on it, but when it dropped you. And there was really nothing at all. So I think that's what we did. We went in and had a look at, you know, what happens when you start dexamethasone and what happens when you're not on dexamethasone. And my memories are, bizarrely, fuel selection was all over the place, which sort of doesn't, well, bizarrely, you know, I mean, because the numbers were very strange, but I suppose I shouldn't be surprised because it's pretty nasty stuff. You know, 40 milligrams of dexamethasone every day, it was pretty solid. You know, it's bound to have some effects. And on top of that, there was all sorts of other stuff I was taking. So, obviously I still had the capacity to exercise. Like you say, I still could do that, and some days you could and some days you couldn't, but as that first, before the stem cell transplant, as time went on, I came to the realization that I couldn't keep functioning at the same physical level as I did before. You just can't do it because the drugs don't allow you to recover. You just get into a hole, and if you keep trying to exercise, you just keep digging the hole bigger.
Yeah, you can really see the difficulty in scientists and doctors trying to prescribe some sort of exercise to some sort of exercise regime for when you're going through chemotherapy, especially if you think about the most of the population, they're not going to be as fit as you or as motivated as you to stay fit. So here you have someone who's really motivated to stay fit, is already really fit. They start chemotherapy. This is you. And it's really hard to keep up an exercise regime. You know, and yours would have been at a higher level than they would probably prescribe to anyone, especially someone who's coming in unfit. But you can see really the difficulty that scientists would have in actually testing a sort of exercise protocol just because of how difficult it was. So it's really hard to get some concrete evidence of how effective and beneficial exercising was for you and how beneficial it could be for someone else.
Yeah, well, of course, the benefits of exercise are not just physical, they're mental as well, and that's a big thing. You know, you've got to sort of look after your mental well-being just as importantly, perhaps more importantly, when you're coping with chemo, but also as a means of trying to battle a cancer and recover. I often thought to myself, there was the odd time, and this is let alone after the stem cell transplant, which you might ask me about later, where I was in that first round, where I remember getting up one day, right, I'm going to go for a walk, and I almost didn't make it round the block, and in fact, I don't think I made it round the block, and I'm thinking to myself at this point, okay, look, I'm pretty fit, you know, it was only a couple of months ago, I'm ticking along at 4-minute Ks. And now I can't walk around the block. So how would someone who's, a cancer patient who's never exercised, how would you then say, oh, you need to keep your exercise up in cancer when I'm thinking I can't walk around the block? It's a tough one. It's a tough one. But the evidence does seem to show that it's exercise in some fashion is beneficial, you know, during treatment and treatment's treatment. People respond differently. And there's absolutely different levels of different levels of treatment that people respond differently to. So, but you know, just a blanket statement like "oh, keep exercising during your cancer treatment," I think is naive at best.
What about diet then? Did you get recommendations on that?
Yeah, see, this is, this is really interesting. The only recommendations I got in terms of diet were you're not allowed to eat grapefruit or green tea because it interferes with the chemotherapy. And I'm thinking, well, I wonder what other things interfere with the chemotherapy, but they've just never bothered to study.
And how did they find that?
Oh, because someone just decided to do an experiment, you know. Oh, because someone found that grapefruit affected, I think, heart medication. So, we'll do that experiment on chemo drugs, see if it does the same thing. Well, geez, if grapefruit does it, I wonder what, figs do or tahini does or yogurt. I mean, who knows? But anyway, I did what I was told.
Is McDonald's good?
Hey?
McDonald's is good?
Well, yeah, I mean, I wasn't. You do keep a bit of sensibility, but I just tried to eat relatively healthy. I mean, there's some times when you just, you know, the cancer treatment affects your ability to take in food. After I had my stem cell transplant, like I said before, that, you know, 3/4 of a gram of melphalan basically kills your gastrointestinal tract for a wee while as well. It just takes all the dividing cells away, and I think I didn't eat anything for a week. I mean, there was times when you just couldn't face looking at anything, and then after about a week, I managed to eat an old orange. Might have been more than a week, and it was like, shit, that was really good. I managed to eat something, and then it takes you months to get your appetite back. And that's just my treatment. People are having different types of treatment all the time. So what, you know, it doesn't become down as you shouldn't eat that or you shouldn't eat this. It's like, well, what actually can I get down my throat? Because at some point you need energy of some sort. And I think that's where lots of the medical side of cancers, they concentrate on, it's more about what you eat, being able to eat than not what you eat. That's not saying that what you eat is not important, because it's vitally important. It's just that we don't really know. So I just tried to eat relatively healthily. Just interesting, you know, I remember I lost 7 kilos in the first 5 months of treatment through stress and through probably not being able to eat and times and what have you. And then one of my GPs said to me, Steve, you're losing too much weight. You need to put some weight on. So my daughter went and just baked me cookies with tahini and chocolate, and I ate some of those and put a bit of weight on, which was good. And I remember saying that, and I was saying, look, you know, at the hospital, I said, well, they had to inject into my body fat, and they couldn't find any at one point. And, And they said, look, you know, here we want people to put on weight. We like weight. We like fat. They love fat in the oncology ward. So, you know, the sort of a lot of the normal sort of nutrition things are quite different in a medical sense.
But what about, I remember we spoke about like a ketogenic diet or ketosis. Did you look more into that? Because from my understanding, cancer cells are, I guess, horribly inefficient. So they are, have a really bad or disjointed electron transport chain and oxidative phosphorylation. So a lot of the metabolism is anaerobic, it's glycolytic. So the base theory suggests that if you starve yourself of glucose and replace with ketones, then that in effect starves the cancer cells.
Yeah.
Were you advised on anything like that?
No, there's nothing like that. See, one of the things is there's no research. You only get advised by the medical profession where there's good evidence. And that's sensible. There's evidence relating to that cancer. So there's no good evidence that changes in diet at all affect multiple myeloma. I think that, you know, in contrast, there's probably some evidence that things like breast cancer can be affected by diet in some way, in a broad sense. Whether or not the research has been done on ketogenic diet, certainly in rodents or animal studies, I think that there's some evidence that things like ketogenic diets can reduce tumours and things like that. When you're doing a stem cell transplant, you can't eat for at all anything for a week, and then for the following months you can eat limited amounts of food. Let me tell you, you're in a ketogenic state at that point. I think I was in a ketogenic state during the I don't doubt that could be beneficial, and certainly now, you know, later on it could be beneficial. On the other hand, you've got to you know, I've tried exercising. I mean, I still think exercise is really important for trying to keep the cancer at bay and just general health and fitness and well-being. It's pretty hard to exercise when you're in starvation. And personally, I'd prefer just to starve to go ketogenic rather than go on a longer-term diet. But I also decided that I was better off looking for really natural foods. This is in recovery from the stem cell transplant than trying to do anything ketogenic. Not that ketogenic would be bad, I don't think, but I thought, well, I'm better off looking for things like anthocyanins, coloured vegetables, really natural stuff, and really natural so that I just go out the garden and pick it off the tree. And that's what I felt, you know, and I did a bit of research as to, you know, what the benchtop studies and what sort of said in terms of particular nutrients might be useful, you know, without human trials and stuff like that, and what sort of foods contain those, and, you know, it was fruit and vegetables and what have you. And the trouble is you can't eat a lot of fruit and vegetables and be ketogenic. So that's what I'd decided.
It's a bit of a rabbit hole though, isn't it, when you start searching online for these different homeopathic remedies for cancer. There are all these broad claims for all different kinds of things, that this helps cure cancer and that helps. Did you find yourself like searching things on Google or WebMD and things like that and coming up with?
Of course, you do. You got to, because actually, knowledge is power when it comes to cancer. It is. Homeopathy is a different ball game, and I haven't touched that. You do, but if it means that, oh, okay, you know, there's particular anthocyanin, you know, that's been shown to help a little bit in terms of killing CD38 proteins, which help myeloma cells proliferate in a petri dish, and it's in apples. Well, then I'm going to eat apples. I'm not going to go overboard, but I've got an apple tree. Why wouldn't I? And that was the approach that I took. You know, you know, without further knowledge or without the clinical trials being done, that's all you can really do. You know, I haven't gone overboard on anything. I had an Easter egg the other day and I feel guilty about it. But then maybe you did too. I don't know.
I did. But overall, you were prescribed your treatment, and outside of that, there was nothing that there's no other recommendations.
No, not really. That's modern medicine, really. You'd be prescribed a treatment based on statistics, based on statistics and weight of evidence, and on what experiments that have been done. No one has done an interventional trial on the effect of exercise and multiple myeloma. No one's even done it on, as I said before, taking dexamethasone. There are enormous holes in the body of knowledge about cancer, exercise, diet, the whole gamut. We just don't know. That's just how it is. So you've got to take charge and try and, this is why knowledge is power, try and work out for yourself what's best. If I can digress a bit, I think, at the moment I'm ticking along pretty well, and my treatment was not 100% effective. Like I say, the cancer's still there in the background, it's still there, but it went reasonably well. And I think a big part of that was reducing stress, reducing stress I felt was really important, a really important part of dealing with this. And not only from a purely psychological sense, and I'm not a psychologist, so there's no expertise there. What I learned was when you take something like dexamethasone, and there might have been something else I take, it's an anti-inflammatory. So you're taking anti-inflammatories because cancer cells love an inflammatory environment to proliferate, right? So, but stress causes inflammation. And in an acute sense, exercise causes inflammation too, doesn't it? Inflammation.
Yeah, yeah.
The thing about being fit, the acute exercise causes inflammation, but when you recover from that and you do really quickly, your systemic basal levels of inflammation are much less.
Yeah, it's very acute. It's not chronic.
So
a lot of other stress.
Chronic inflammation is really bad in a whole lot of ways. And I think we're finding out more and more about that all the time. And going back to, I think I said you need to ask me why do I think I got this in the first place? I think partly just chronic stress.
Yeah, I was about to ask that, because it's non-hereditary as far as I understand.
Pretty much. I'll get back to that. But, when you take some of these pills, taking some of these pills, all I'm doing in a way is using chemotherapy to reduce the effects of stress. So why don't I just take out the stressful factors in my life anyway? And so I quit my job pretty much, or I wasn't there. So the best thing I did was not be at work, because I found that quite stressful. And that was making time to sort of try and relax, I think, was important. When you talk to cancer survivors, or you read the books, what they say is you're trying to reduce stress, have time to meditate, and that's all about reducing inflammation, reducing stress. And so if you can do that as well as take the anti-inflammatory drugs, it's probably a good thing. Exercise is really important because it reduces systemic inflammation. And, they don't tell you that, but I had to work that out for myself. So that's why, partly why I tried to keep exercising.
Yeah, so does that's how you think, in your case, the cancer came about?
You never know. I mean, there's genetic factors, there's environmental factors, but I certainly think stress has a big part to play. I had quite a few years of, as I say, burning a candle at all different ends. And so physical stress, but I think there was aspects of mental stress in my life that I should have seen, but the trouble was, I think there's an expectation, and again now when I look back, it's really wrong, that a job has to be stressful.
Yeah, well, not uncommon for us to get an email from Steve at 3 a.m.
It's because I'd get up in the middle of the night stressed about something, and you think, okay, well, I'm up, I may as well just work, and you'd write a paper or something like that, and the danger is that becomes normal. Oh, I'm up, I may as well just do something, and then you try and stay up, or you go back to bed, or then you have three cups of coffee to try and stay awake later in the day. And that starts, you look back on that and you think, well, that's not entirely healthy. I mean, if you enjoy the coffee and, you know, that's all right. But, you know, and the trouble is that then became normalised. And I thought it was normal. I just thought that was part of life in a fairly stressful working environment. I just thought that's what you had to do. I so wish I knew then what I know now. It's not normal.
No, I remember seeing like the amount of things that you were doing and still like riding more than myself, and you have a family, and you had your own business, you had a full-time job at the university. I couldn't believe how much you were actually doing in a day. It just blew my mind. And it sounds like that, you know, became normal for you, but it also wasn't easy.
It was very stressful. You know, I could tell you some stories about having to get up at 1 a.m., drive one of your kids down to the airport to get on an international flight, drive home, go to work in your lunchtime, go down and make sure that the cafe wasn't burnt down, and then finishing work, going to the cafe, cleaning up and going home and trying to get up again and do some exercise before breakfast the next day. And that was just normal sort of stuff. But, yeah, I just thought it was normal, but it's not normal.
No.
It's not. And how, like, in terms of exercise, I remember – yeah, like sometimes you could barely push the pedals over. Where are you? 18 months, almost 2 years, I guess.
I'm 18 months after my last round of chemo.
Yeah.
And
like you're still racing.
I was. See, it hasn't been all beer and Skittles. I have periods where chemo is pretty nasty, and it takes a while to get over. When you stop, it takes quite a while for it to get over its effects. I mean, and probably I never will. I think there's probably some damage. It's pretty nasty stuff, some permanent damage that's been done. One thing that I have had a problem with is I can exercise for a while, and then I get run down really easily. I get run down really easily, and I think that's possibly because I get pernicious anemia now. I'm trying to investigate it with help from a doctor about why I get so run down quickly. I'm not on top of it, but there's long-term effects of undergoing a stem cell transplant, which means that, you know, the gone are the days of my VO2 max getting over 5.5 liters per minute, you know, it's just how it is. You're just more fragile.
Are you building fitness? Can you get?
Oh, look, I can't. Again,
the maintenance.
Yeah, and it's a longer story. I mean, I've just been through a period of I started racing again, doing some last year, and I started racing in 3 months after my stem cell transplant, and I was going okay. But what happens is you just end up getting run down really quickly. And I'm trying to investigate exactly why. It could be just the new me. It could be a nutritional thing. I think it's possibly I get anemic really easily now because I can't absorb B12. I don't know if that's the case, but it seems to be possibly what the problem is. I can get pretty fit, but I can't hang on to that fitness. And then I've got to just park it for a while and recover. I seem to get overtrained really easily now. That's what seems to happen. So I can't build fitness all the time. It's an up and down process.
But like you're still like pretty fit, and you got fit again really, really quickly after your treatment. So
yeah,
could you give us an idea of maybe some numbers of like how your threshold dipped and then came up and
from when you had your stem cell transplant, you know, you hit VO2 max by getting out of bed and walking up and down the hallway, basically. I couldn't, you know, I struggled to climb a set of stairs without someone's help. 3 months later, I was out. I think I probably won my age group, the club championships. I could do interclubs. I was knocking out some pretty good, no, seriously, 3 months later, I was knocking out some okay times in the local club time trial. The end of last year, I still got busy aspects of my life and I don't always have time to ride, but the end of last year, I managed to knock out my fastest time for about 4 years in the local club time trial. But so this is from before I got the cancer. I just have a down patch and away I go, and I've got to lose fitness and recover a little bit. I reckon the whole stem cell transplant, in terms of my threshold, is probably knocked about, talking numbers, it's probably knocked about over the space of it. Let's say 4 years, because, you know, that probably, yeah, probably about 4 years. I reckon I've lost about 60 watts off my threshold. That's pretty substantial.
Because it would have been... what, about 350?
A bit more maybe. If I think about what I could hold in a 12K time trial, so about 18 minutes, it's probably about 380. And then, you know, if I could hold 320 now, I'd be pretty happy, which is a little bit hard.
You are about 70 kgs?
Yeah, about 71 kgs, something like that. So, That's just how it is. It actually doesn't worry me at all. It's a bit disheartening to see what you could do, what you can. Yeah. Put it this way, I've checked my calibration on my power meter a couple of times.
I remember going over to your house. You thought your power meter was wrong, so we hung a weight off of your pedal just to recalibrate it. We had to hack into the system just to check. But, yeah, you know... I think that like really shows that like you pretty much, you were at this really, really high level and you were pretty much down to zero fitness. And actually, I'm sure it wasn't easy, but it didn't take you really long to get back in the mix and become like a local hotshot again. And like, you're really fit. So no matter where you were, like you'd still be competitive, definitely in your age group. And, you know, for the record, you still jump in the local criteriums in the middle of the week and you ride with the elites, the A grade. So I think, you know, it's really inspiring to kind of show that you were at a high level, you were down to zero, and quickly you made it back to a high level again. Not as high as you'd like to be. But.
Yeah, so I think that was the benefit of being fit. So when other people were talking about it took them a month after the stem cell transplant to walk to their letterbox, I was walking to the letterbox in a week. In a month, I was out doing 50K rides. And in 3 months, I was out doing interclub races, whereas people were still struggling to walk down and get the paper. That's what being fit going into it. That's what it does. My recovery was far better. Actually, it was even interesting when I had my stem cells harvested, you know, that you go in and you basically go under dialysis, and they hope they can get enough stem cells in one go at it, because it's a bit of an ordeal, you know, lying there in the bed for, I don't know, 7 or 8 hours with a couple of steel needles in your arm. You're not allowed to move, and especially if you want to go to the toilet. It's difficult, and you don't want to go through it again. So you think, oh, I hope they've harvested enough stem cells. But when they, otherwise you've got to go back and do it again. Shit, I don't want to do this. Anyway, when they did mine, they harvested enough stem cells for 5.5 transplants, which was like, well, you didn't need to take so much out. But I think partly that was, whereas a lot of people, they've got to go back because they only get enough for half a transplant. And so for me, I think being fit helped with all of those processes, absolutely helped.
Then what would you like, what would be your recommendations? What would be your, like, there's people suffering from cancer every single day. Like, what would be your words to them around kind of anything, really?
Well, the first one is, you've got to take the glass half full approach.
Because you could have, I'm sure, like you say it, I was there when you were going through this, so was Matt. You say, oh yeah, and 1 month and then 3 months, but that 3 months took every single day of every single, you know, there was hours of the day where it wasn't just like, yeah, click of the fingers, we're 3 months in. You had to work at it. You couldn't just in 3 months be fit. You know, nothing gets given to anyone, but you had to want to get back there, right?
Yeah, you do. You've got to take a glass half full approach and think, yeah, you got to sort of be determined. You got to say, okay, this is where I'm going. This is what I want to do. And you can't. I think, you know, they talk about rock pants. You've got to be strong. What I learned was being strong it's saying, okay, well, you know, being strong, it's about saying, okay, well, I know that, you know, going for a walk around the block's going to be good for me. And I feel shit, but I've got to get up and do it. That's being strong. You need physical strength, you need mental strength to do that. And you've got to say, okay, I'm going to try and have a crack at, you know, beating this. And in my case, I can't completely beat it, probably can't, but I can damn well make sure I'm doing the best. And you've got to do that. Mentally, you've got to have this attitude of you know, I can do this, or it's the glass half full approach, not, oh, woe is me, I can't do this. You can't have a defeatist approach. I'll tell you a little story. You probably want to wind it up, but I'll tell you a little story I went in there one time. I was in hospital in the oncology ward, and it was when I had to go in. I'd just done this course of injections to mobilize my stem cells before they got harvested, and then I had to go in, and they took a blood test first thing in the morning to see whether I was ready to get them harvested. And I went in one morning, I took a blood test, it took an hour or something to get the results, and meanwhile I was just waiting there and in oncology, and a bloke had come in with a drip hanging out his arm, his dressing gown, and I had a chat with him, and I said, you know, what are you in here, as you do, you know, well, what are you in here for? Oh, yeah, I'm in here, I'm just waiting for my... I got myeloma, and I'm just waiting for my stem blood sample to get processed before they tell me I've got to get my stem cells harvested. And I said to him, and I asked him, yeah, what are you in here for? He says, oh, I got bowel cancer. He said, I'm doing treatment for bowel cancer, and yeah, I've had pneumonia, so I've been in here for like, you know, 2 weeks or something, and I'm just getting over it, which is good. And I said, oh, how'd you know you had that? And he said, I was lucky. I was lucky. I got diagnosed at stage 3, and I said, if I'd been diagnosed at stage 4, I would have been fucked. But you know, and I thought, shit, you know, and here's me, got diagnosed with no symptoms at stage 1. And this guy's got the glass half full, and he got diagnosed at stage 3. I haven't seen him since. You know, he had a couple of young kids but he was a real example, and that's how you got to be.
Sweet. And probably just the final question I'd ask would be, how has it changed your outlook on life? Like, you're only 51 now, 52, early 50s. What's like, are you reducing stress? I know you run a UCI level 2 race, a cafe, have 3 kids and a rental property.
So what was the question again? How has it changed my life? I've certainly reduced stress. I look for opportunities to try and reduce stress. That's really important. I don't do as much. I try and find quiet time every day. I guess I'm less likely to suffer fools gladly. I say, I don't like people wasting my time. Don't waste my time, because I don't know how much time I've got. Like, seriously, I don't think I could go back and work at the university. There's too many time wasters there. You know, I don't waste my time. And that's you become a bit like that. A bit more politely brutal, I would say. That's fine. I drive a really old Land Rover, which you've seen. It's like a tractor. It does 0 to 100 in 50 seconds. In fact, it doesn't even reach 100, so that's probably in infinity. And the beauty of that is that was actually quite therapeutic. I was driving that when chemo, because before I went through this whole thing, I'd get behind the wheel. I don't have time. Look, can't you see the light's gone green? I've got to rush because I've got to get from here. I've got to go to there. And I'd get worked up about stuff. And you drive the old Land Rover and you can't go anywhere fast. And no one, the other thing, so you can't go fast. So life's got to slow down at the rate of the 1971 Series 2A. And that was a really good thing. It's strange, isn't it? But I had to slow down to the rate of my 1971 Series 2A Land Rover, which was really slow, and it just doesn't go fast. And the thing about it is nobody toots you anyway, because they know it's such an old thing. It was sort of quite good. So yeah, that's changed things a bit. I do find one thing I've certainly found is going through all this, it knocked my confidence really badly. When you do chemo, it has physical effects, but those physical effects also are on the way your mind works. So there were some pretty, you probably remember, I was some pretty clouded days where I didn't, you know, I couldn't multitask. I took a long time to make decisions. I wouldn't want to have been driving heavy machinery, put it that way. Luckily, I was driving a Land Rover, because you can't do anything quickly. And it really knocks your confidence. And I think that I'm probably still suffering a bit from that. I talked to a friend who'd been through it all as well, and a couple of times he's had to do a couple of rounds of treatment for lymphoma, and he said, yeah, it's the same thing, knocks your confidence. And but it also knocks other people's confidence in you, I think, which is a real shame, because people with... And so, actually, I think your opportunities to get involved in things might diminish, because people think, oh, you know, he's had cancer, you know, might not have long to go, or, you know, it's screwed with his brain, or he's somehow or another damaged. Well, in fact, I think it's probably the opposite. You become a lot wiser. The wisest person I ever talked to was a friend of mine that had terminal cancer, and you know, he could talk about things in a way that no one else could.
Awesome. I think that's wise advice. So I know one of the things you've been doing lately is writing a bunch of articles, putting your mind in the public sphere. So if people want to follow you, what's the best method for doing that?
You know, I don't know. Look me up on Facebook. I'm on Twitter, but I don't really use it. I'm there on Facebook somehow or another, or just look out for my articles on stuff that I get published every now and again.
Or one of your 150 scientific articles, if someone has some real time to burn.
Yeah, if I want to see what I got involved in over the years, well, that's fine too. That's a way to do it as well. But you just Google me.
All right. Well, we appreciate you coming back on, Steve, and I'm sure we'll have you again. We've got some other hot topics that could do with your opinion. So otherwise, enjoy the rest of your day.
Yeah, will do. Thanks very much. Always good to chat.
All right. Thanks. See you later.
See ya.
All right, That was a really great show. We really appreciate Steve coming on and talking about his really personal details. And I hope you found that insightful. Follow along with us on performanceadvantagepodcast.com, where you can keep up to date with the show and our training course. And if you have any suggestions or tips for the show to help us improve the show, send that over to us, and we are happy to take your advice on board. As always, if you can share the show with your friends, it really helps us get the word out, and that helps motivate us to keep going and give you more information.